Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. I begin in the name of a God whose mercy is profound, whose kindness is forever. Ladies and gentlemen, why do we need religion? My understanding from the reading of the Quran is that God has given us religion in response to a strong yearning that we have within us for religion. It is not very different from the case of water. We were given the need for water and we were provided with water. So one was in response to the other. It was not very different from the case of food. We get hungry and God provided us with food. Likewise, probably an even more relevant example is of air that we breathe. Our existence was impossible had we not had air the way it is found in the atmosphere. We needed it and it was provided. The manner of this system is functioning, if we are able to prove the genuine need for something else, the way things are operating, that something else has also got to be there. I find the Quran mentioning the divine revelation, the message from God that has come to guide humanity, described as risk, which is sustenance. It is a sustenance that has come down to us from God, quite the same way as we have sustenance that is provided to meet our material physical needs. Similarly, we have sustenance which is there to satisfy our, call it, intellectual and spiritual needs. Now, what are those needs and why do we think that there is a definite need? Imagine a person who has come to this world without any clear understanding of religion. You've always got to presume somebody who is decent, normal, well-meaning, good human being. The way this life has been designed, people have been given liberty and freedom to choose to do whatever they want to, and at times they choose to do things which are not exactly natural, not what their nature requires. Why? Because life is exciting, glamorous. At times when you do things which are otherwise wrong, you get immediate pleasure, and therefore people sometimes do not pay heed what is otherwise natural, which makes a lot of sense. We've come to this world and we do realize that, as I said, we've got lots and lots of needs. What we find is that the needs are being met. You might say that there are problems. Well, the question of problems is different. I'm right now talking about the fact that we've got so many needs and those needs are being met. The kind of human that we are, we know that there is ingrained in our nature an inclination to be grateful to the one who is coming to our help. We therefore have in our language expressions like thank you, I'm really grateful, shukriya, shukr, and so on. This is because it is human nature. If somebody is favoring you, if you cannot do anything else, well, you should please say thank you. And honest to God, this life that we are leading, I'm sure you would agree, is full of blessings that we are availing, benefiting from. Every day, every morning, every evening. We didn't deserve it. We didn't do anything to get it. It's just happening. And a good human is therefore always obliged, inclined to know where it's coming from and to say thank you. To just express feelings of gratitude that are naturally there. I'm not talking about the question of existence of God, whether he's there or not, but I keep mentioning the fact when I talk about the possibility of the existence of God, that the existence of God and the question of it is not primarily an intellectual question. It is primarily a moral question. Every human would want to know who is the one who has caused my life to be designed. It's brilliant. And who is the one who, after having given me my life, is also ensuring that whatever this life is demanding, requiring, is being adequately met. Somebody said that, well, is it not that there are people who are starving to death? Are you not kidding? Well, I responded to the person by saying that, look here, honestly, starvation is not a problem of production. Starvation is not a problem of production. Starvation is a problem of distribution. In other words, there has been no time, no era, when this world in general, taken together, has not produced enough for all people's need for food to be adequately catered for. It's only that because this life is a trial. Some people have food more than what they need, and others have less. And it was for those who had more to distribute and share it with those who had less. So what I'm trying to say is that, honest to God, you know, one feels obliged to be thankful to the one who is doing all this. Then, the life that we are leading is also an occasion, an experience, wherein we every now and then get reasons to feel that we're not in complete control and command of ourselves. We are vulnerable, we are weak, we are dependent. At times, we do feel confident because we've got some strength, some ability to take decisions. Some occasions when we feel on top of the world. But then most certainly there are many other occasions when we feel that just good for nothing, we're weak, and we need the help of somebody else who should come to our rescue, on whom we should have our faith, we should rely on the being. And that feeling of vulnerability is another reality that all humans go through. There is another aspect of human life that one cannot deny, and that is, although somehow we all humans have been given in our conscience a very strong need, a very strong inclination to get justice done. Justice in itself is a very broad concept, understanding, need. But we have this feeling that, you know, there should be justice. That people should be dealt with in a manner which is fair. Now what is happening is instead that we do get glimpses of justice here and there, just to probably as if to reconfirm that it's something which is good, desirable. But more often than not, we go through experiences wherein this world turns out to be an unfair place, and people use their freedom incorrectly to cause harm to others by being just the opposite of what they were designed to be. People are unjust, unfair, because they have got their own base desires which they pursue and therefore ignore the very clear, loud voice asking them to be fair. Because they have got their egos which cause them not to acknowledge what is right, what is true, what is fair. So justice is what we all humans ask for, but justice is elusive. It doesn't happen, and it doesn't happen because of our own undoing. So that is another problem. A linked problem is the problem of morality. There's something inside us all humans, that is every now and then telling us that, you know, there's certain things that need to be done. And at times we are okay, lucky, and inclined to do what the demand of our morality is. But then quite often we find that our conscience, our sense of morality and ethics is demanding something else. And what people in general are doing is quite the opposite. And of course, there again is a mind, a noble person, a decent human being, a well-meaning individual is confused. What's going on? It's not making sense. It's not what I desire. And finally, there is something else in this life, which is as if every day trying to tell us that, look here, this life has problems. There's something that needs to be done about it. And that is, you know what? The problem of death. Life is brilliant. It has its problems, but it still is brilliant. On the balance, we love it. We don't want to part with it. Death is a tragedy. And of course, despite the fact that we all know that one day we're going to die, the truth of the matter is that we don't want to die. So what's going on? It is as if inside us, there is another world, there is another demand. And in the outside world of reality, there's something endless going on. From inside, we don't want to die. From outside, we are given to understand that we've got to die. So we still again, you know, we come to the same problem. That this life is asking for something. Some understanding, some message comes to our rescue to help us know what exactly is the reality of this life. What is it that we are expected to do? And that is what causes the need for religion to be there. If there are people, good humans, decent people who are living and going through all these problems, and nobody can avoid these problems, then the person would be dissatisfied. There will be discontentment deep inside the soul. And such individuals would be looking for some answer. Because without getting answers to these important problems that we all confront, we cannot remain content, satisfied. I have a theory which you can challenge, but I have a feeling that many people resort to alcoholism, intoxicating drinks, precisely for that reason. You know, you don't have answers to questions, and these problems are all the time disturbing us, staring into our eyes. How can people sleep? How can people face that reality? They would like to live a life wherein the short-term objectives are the only goals that they are worrying about. But they're fooling themselves. They know that that's not something that would satisfy them. If they do not have an ideology, a message that would come to their rescue and answer their questions and give them adequate reasons to believe that even though these problems are there, there are definite solutions to the problems. If that is not the case, then I think the other possibility is that they should resort to some measure that would enable them to not worry, to live in a way for some time their worries just disappear. And they live in a world of illusion. Just forget everything. So, what I'm trying to say and emphasize is that when God tells us that His message is actually something that is natural, naturally needed by humans, well, that need is definitely there. I've mentioned a few points, and I'm sure that there could be many more that could be mentioned to show that we as humans do need God's guidance. In order for God's guidance to be acceptable, it must satisfy two conditions. One is the condition of authenticity, and the other is the condition of it being convincing. Islam, the message that was brought by all prophets, messengers of God, and which came to its culmination as a consequence of it being presented once again in its pristine form by the last messenger, Muhammad, God's mercy be on him, is authentic in the sense that if you look at it the way it was presented, even as a common ordinary person, you, even without going to the libraries and investigating through books, can get a feeling that this is exactly the same message that was presented by the messenger who claimed to be the messenger of God. There is a book called the Quran, which is fully preserved in a way that you can feel confident that it is the same book that was presented right from day one. Because it's the only text, the only version that is accepted by all Muslims. And it's not really something that happened by accident. It is something that happened because of the fact that the book was memorized by a good number of people in the first generation. The number was far greater in the second generation. It further improved in the third generation. And the trend has gone on. So it really is a foolproof process which could have gone wrong. So we've got a reason to feel that the book is the same that was presented by the one who presented it as the book of God. And a similar case could be presented for the rituals, the religious practices of the messenger called Sunnah. He prayed, for example, five times a day, and his prayer was done in a manner that he was followed by a good number of followers each time he prayed. So he prayed and he required others to pray. And this process continued even after his demise. When the first generation of Muslims left this world, the prayer was going on in the second generation and the third generation. And it has come to us as a confirmed, authentic form of worship that was given to us by the messenger of God. Had it been given to us by anybody else, there would have been different versions of it. You might say that there are indeed differences. But the fact of the matter is that quite often we don't look at the commonalities, things that are common to all Muslims who worship. I don't want to count them, I just want to mention that if there are differences, well, the reason is that the differences were allowed to happen. The reason was that the messenger prayed and allowed people to pray in details in a way that turned out to be different for different people on different occasions. But if you look at the commonalities, well, their list is much longer and taller. The message also has to be convincing. You know, you have to be confident that it's coming from the source that came to be God's messenger. Because the the need, the problem, the hunger, the thirst was created by God. So the water, the food had to come from God. And that food is His message. It came from the earlier messengers indeed, and then it came in its past form, which is not very different from the earlier forms. But it was preserved. Do not be allowed to get tampered with and changed, altered, because no new prophet would come. So once you feel that this is exactly the same message and no human has altered or attempted to what they might call improve with the passage of time, but it's the very same message, the next thing to find out is it convincing? Is it making sense? Well, it is of course always for the objective reader, observer, to find out whether the message is convincing or not. And for that, the Almighty has allowed all humans their own right, freedom of choice and prerogative to decide whether it is making sense or not. But what I would say at the end of my presentation are two things that are only mentioned to invite the attention of individuals who are interested in knowing it, that it's very likely to be convincing. One of the things that I would mention is that in response to all the needs, all the problems that are there that actually give rise to the need for religion, the message of God in Islam is providing, I think, hopefully, adequately convincing answers. We needed to thank somebody, and we have been informed that the one who needs to be thanked is our God, our Creator, our Sustainer. The All-Knowing, the All-Wise, the All-Powerful, the Fair, the Just. You thank Him and He hears you. And you put your forehead down in prostration and you are very close to Him. No wonder that when you are prostrating before God, thanking Him and at times expressing your regrets for the wrongs you've done, you get a feeling that, you know, there's hardly any other thing that you would do in this world that would make you more satisfied. It is because what you're doing then is what you were expected to do. Contrast it with a situation where somebody is wealthy, successful, famous, well-connected, powerful, and has sleepless nights, discontentment. There is another person who has none of these virtues, but has the virtue of the ability to prostrate before God and say, "Oh God, I'm really sorry, I didn't perform as well as you deserve." And what he gets is a complete satisfaction and contentment of heart, as if he has been spiritually cleansed. That in itself, I think, should be enough for a well-meaning individual to feel that I've got it. I was hungry and I've got it. Really is delicious. We are vulnerable and we pray to God, and we've been informed you pray to Him directly, no matter whether you're alone or in the company of others. You are in the pitch darkness of the night or you are in the broad daylight praying to Him. He hears. The only condition is that you pray sincerely. It is coming from inside the core of your heart. And He hears. It's not just a feeling that you are given to believe because you want to fool yourself. At times you get the indication of it. You pray and you can see that it's happening. So we are vulnerable, we are weak, and we are not left without any support. He's there, and we pray to Him. There is injustice. No doubt there is injustice. But then why should there not be injustice in a world which was meant to be a trial, where the necessary condition of a trial, that is freedom to be given to the people who are being tried, was provided. And because they are free, therefore they are unfair. I mean, if you were not free to choose, you would probably be forced by God to do things which are just and fair. But then how would you have been different from chairs, and the camera and the stars and the dog and the wolf. Because you're humans, because you've been tried, therefore you're free. And because you're free, therefore you can be unfair. So what is the problem? That's how it should be. But if there's no other way, if there's no other life, then of course it's a problem. But if this life is a life of trial, and the next life is going to be a life of reward and punishment to last forever, then it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. That's how it should be. And that is what the answer provided to us is. And not only for injustice, but also for all other aspects of human morality. Wherein you respect them, you value them, and you're not getting returns for them necessarily. And you're not getting returns for them because this life is not primarily a life for getting rewarded or punished. It's a life of trial. And, you know, the voice of conscience, which is loud and clear for the one who has the right pair of ears to hear, and is mute and inaudible for somebody who doesn't care to hear. You just hear the voice of your conscience and you follow it, and you get the understanding from God's message that even if you are being undermined, insulted, subjected to punishment, ridicule, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Life is very soon going to come to an end, and there's going to be another life where you'll be successful. And the success of that life is what really matters. So, again, the problem is over. The hunger was there, and you got a well-cooked, roasted chicken. You ate and said, goodness, the hunger is gone. My need has been satisfied. And finally, of course, the problem of death is solved by the fact that the next life will have everything but not death. Death is going to be all over in the next life, and therefore it's a life that will actually be natural. It will be in response to the natural need of humans to experience eternity. Finally, it is convincing. I'm not going to talk about it at length because it is a subject in its own right to be talked about for a longer duration. The fact that when the Quran invites the reader to believe in God, to believe in the hereafter, to believe in the message that He has sent to the messengers, the Almighty doesn't say that, you know, I, God the Almighty, is telling you that believe, and you believe, and don't dare do anything else. Far from that. What God is doing is that He is all the time, while inviting the reader to believe, is inviting his or her intellect to ponder and reflect and look at the arguments that the Almighty is presenting. And if the arguments are understood, are appreciated in the right spirit, God says that the reader would be indeed satisfied that the message is from God. But as I said, of course, it's not an occasion for me to go into the details of it. I'm just saying that in order for it to appear convincing, God has actually required that part of our personality, which is the only part, only feature, which can actually draw conclusions and take decisions. That is the intellect. So God says every now and then in the Quran, you ponder and reflect over it, and you will know that what the book is saying is right. Well, just mention one quote from the Quran, and then I invite questions. The Quran says in one verse, chapter 4, verse 82, أَفَلَا يَتَدَبَّرُونَ الْقُرْآنَ. Do they not ponder over the Quran, the Quranic verses? وَلَوْ كَانَ مِنْ عِنْدِ غَيْرِ اللَّهِ. Had it been from anyone other than God, لَوَجَدُوا فِي اخْتِلَافًا كَثِيرًا. They would have found there a lot of contradictions, a lot of discrepancy. So, with that, I am now inviting questions, and I just wanted to clarify that if religion is presented by God, it is presented because there is a need for religion in human beings. Thank you.
About any religion whatsoever, living in a remote area, they live the whole life and they die without even hearing about any religion, let alone Islam. What happens with them in front of God?
Okay, what I understand from the Quran through the reading of a number of passages, but more particularly from a passage which makes it very clear, which is the verse 42 of chapter number 7. The Almighty says that those who believe and do good deeds, this is one part of the statement. And the third part of the statement is, such are the deserving rightful residents of the paradise, they're going to live there forever. But the second part of the statement, which is inserted between the first and the third, is a qualifying statement, a clarifying statement. And the Almighty says, we're not going to make anyone accountable for anything beyond his or her potential. In other words, the qualification for entering the paradise is faith and good deeds. But how much faith, to what extent, and how much good deeds, to what extent? God says, I do not expect humans to perform more than what is possible for them. And it is only God who can decide as to whether a person's capacity is more or less. Your and my capacity are comprised of two components. My natural endowments, my intellect, my other attributes, and my environment. So both taken together will decide as to what my capacity is. Thankfully, it is going to be decided by God, the all-knowing, the kind and the generous and the wise, as to what my capacity was, which would decide ultimately as to what would be the level of performance that he would expect from me. And if I would come to the minimum level, he would let me go and enable me to avail the minimum reward. A person who never heard any message from God directly will not be expected to do as best as those who knew the message. And of course, knowing the message itself really has a number of different possibilities. It will all depend on who you are and what your capacity is. So, that should not be a problem. If you are a human, you have an intellect and you have a conscience, and you live in a society, or even if you are living in isolation, there's a certain level of expectation, minimum level of expectation, which the Almighty has from you, which is natural, which is fair. And it's only to that extent that you expect it to do. If you don't do that, it's only then that you will come.
Any other question?
And I suppose a similar sort of question, but with regard to the Christianity and the
right. Anybody, I mean Christians, Jews, whoever, at times I worry about, used to worry about the Chinese. God has created them in such large number. They don't seem to have any formal religion that they would follow. But thanks to the understanding that I've now got from the Quran, they're going to be held accountable on the basis of what they knew, what they could know. It is therefore not very surprising that you find in the Quran, while people are very fond of mentioning passages which talk about God's displeasure with the conduct of some Jews and some Christians, but they fail to mention the other passages which talk about the fact that some of them are brilliant, some of them are performing so well that none of their good deeds are going to be eroded, wasted. Who would belong to what category is what God would decide. Most certainly, when the messenger of God was there, because of his presence, because of his impeccable character, because of the effective presentation of the message, because of the fact that his immediate addressees knew the language and they were pretty aware of the fact that what he was telling them was true, not immediately, after the lapse of a certain duration, beyond which the Almighty said that, "Now I know for sure that all those who have chosen to stay on the wrong side of the divine are actually knowingly, deliberately rejecting the truth, despite knowing full well that it's from God." Those were the people who were condemned in the Quran. Unfortunately, many people have chosen to generalize those statements. I have nobody to say that there are people who are not covered by those statements or are covered by those statements. But I'm also equally worried about Muslims who claim that they believe in the Quran to be God's word. Now, when you make that statement and claim, you are actually setting the standards for yourself, for you to be judged against. So, you know, when we talk about Christians and Jews, well, God is going to judge them on the basis of what he genuinely knows as to what they knew. And of course, he's fair. He's not biased. Many religious people, Muslims, Jews, Christians and others, are very fond of thinking, believing that God actually favors them to the exclusion of everybody else. I think, let's be fair to God. God is fair. All humans are God's creation. And therefore, he's going to judge them on the basis of merit of their performance. And he's going to be absolutely fair and completely unbiased. So yes, I mean, whether you're talking about Jews or Christians, it really is the same. And it is a benchmark, it is a criterion that he has clearly mentioned. And everybody is going to be judged on the basis of that criterion. It is quite another matter. That criterion is something that actually causes every individual to be unique and different because of his, her peculiar circumstances and therefore a different capacity, which is what is going to be the ultimate principle on the basis of which people are going to be judged.
Sorry, I'm late. So, can I ask, were there any humans before Adam alayhi salam?
What I understand, this is a very intriguing area of understanding and research. What I understand as yet is that there were many Adam-like living beings before Adam. But Adam and Eve were the first pair that was conferred with the status of being humans. So, you know, if you're talking about the physical features, yes, it's more likely that there were many before them, according to my understanding of the Quran. Don't accuse or blame me of being influenced by the theory of revolution. I just completely ignore that theory and try to read the Quran and get an impression that what is more likely to happen is there was a long process that was followed until such time that there came a time when those living beings reached a stage where the Almighty decided that now is the time that this spirit is going to be given the status of human beings by being given the experience of God breathing into them His breath, which of course is a metaphorical expression. What exactly does it mean, we don't know. But what it actually means clearly is what the Quran says, that as a consequence of that experience, the two of them were able to get the ability to think, ponder, and reflect, and to sift right from wrong. They were able to hear and see and decide. So those important decisive attributes that the humans have, as against and different from non-humans, is what was conferred to this pair for the very first time. If prior to them there were others who looked like them, it is a possibility. I'm not confirming that it is 100% certain, but some Quranic passages lead one to feel that it may have been a possibility.
There's one confusion when you say we are responsible for our own actions, and the other side says we're predestined, there's one thing of free will. So how do you reconcile the data?
Right. On the one hand, everything is, it is claimed, predestined. So what I'm speaking, I have to speak. I have no choice. And on the other hand, we have this understanding that if I'm speaking something which is incorrect, God will ask me, why did you speak? And will I be able to say, sir, I mean, I spoke because you just pushed the button and it just started happening. Well, you know what happens in this case of the question of predestination and free will is, and let me add another dimension to it, that it is said that the Prophet, may God's mercy be on him, when he found that some of his companions were debating about predestination, he discouraged them. And of course, then again, some eyebrows are raised and they say that you claim that it is the intellect that leads you to understand your religion. And here is a good example of the intellect being stopped and not allowed to be utilized for the purpose of understanding. Let me try to explain. You see, when you are talking about God, let it be clear that you're not talking about a fellow human being. You're not even talking about a superhuman. You're talking about God. And you know what the difference is? Even though we share many of the attributes of God, there are some vital differences. I know, and God knows, but there ends the similarity. He knows everything, and I know very little. He knows everything that happened in the past. He knows everything that is happening now, and he knows everything that is going to happen in the future. If there is any problem, any deficiency, anything lacking in his knowledge, he's not a God. God is perfect, and I am imperfect. Likewise, God is fair, is just, and like knowledge, like might, power, like wisdom, his justice is also perfect and complete. Add to it another dimension, that God's all attributes, and he has got all the good attributes, are all complete, perfect, infinite. And they are all simultaneously functioning. It's not that at times his wisdom is sleeping, dormant, and on other occasions it's active. No, it's active, functional all the time. Now, when you get introduced to all these facts, ladies and gentlemen, I think should realize that we can only have an idea of what he is. We cannot grasp it. We cannot absorb it. Not because it's wrong. Not because there is any fault in the idea. But because our intellect, after all, is limited. You know, I can see. You can see. But is it not that we keep telling ourselves, our kids, don't stare at the sun. when it is shining. Why not? Because our ability to see is limited. And it's going to be spoiled. It's going to be affected negatively. We're going to keep staring at the sun. Sadly, it so happens that humans don't want to admit, accept the fact that even though their every other ability is limited, they think that their intellect is unlimited. But certainly not. Like any other thing, their intellect also has its limits. Now let's come to the point of predestination. Predestination is something that has got primarily to do with God's knowledge. He knows everything that is going to happen in the future. But apart from being perfectly knowledgeable, God is also perfectly fair. And the two are not contradicting each other. They're not at odds with each other. His knowledge of the future requires that he should know what I'm going to do tomorrow. But his sense of justice requires that if I'm going to be held accountable for something I'll do tomorrow, it should be only if I do it freely and I'm not forced to do it. And that is what it is. So in case if an individual does something tomorrow which is wrong and is going to be held accountable and punished for it, God would know beforehand that the person is going to do it on that particular day, but he's going to do it on his own volition, freely, without being forced by God's knowledge of it beforehand. But this is something which, of course, is beyond me. But if there is something beyond me, it's not necessarily because it's wrong, but it's simply because my grasp is limited. We talk about God, we don't talk about humans. That is why the Prophet, may God mercy be on him, said that, well, don't talk about it beyond a point, because you're just going to get confused. You're talking about somebody who is perfect. And therefore be absolutely sure that, you know, his attributes are there. But by the way, he did something. And he keeps doing something for us humans to let us know that, look here, you know, I know. And I know everything. You know what happens? It happens quite often. What happens is that we experience dreams. Dreams of things happening in the future. And I'm sure that you would agree with me that on some occasions it's so surprisingly, shockingly happens that what I had dreamt of 10 days ago comes completely and fully true, is realized. And you know what happens after I've dreamt of something in the future? What happens is not an accident. It's not necessarily a rainfall or a volcano. It is something that happens as a consequence of a number of decisions taken by different humans, all choosing free to decide about a certain thing in their own respective environment. And they all come together and that event takes place, which has already been experienced. My goodness. But this, I think, God does. He does that. Look here. You know you have your limitations. What I'm telling you is true. That is how it is. If you don't understand it, well, be clear that your understanding has its limitations. You know, it really is going to be a case of intellectual arrogance. Somebody says that, look here, I'm sorry, I don't understand it, so it's wrong. It's wrong. You don't understand it because you don't have the ability to understand it. It's like, you know, if you are a student of class 6 of mathematics, and in comes a teacher who has done his PhD in mathematics, and he writes an equation, and he said, boys and girls, this is true. And a young chap says, sir, no, it's wrong, I don't understand it. So, I mean, what can be done about it? You know? The poor chap has to be informed that, okay, if you don't understand it, it doesn't really necessarily mean that it's wrong. I remember my daughter and my son, they would, when they were young, they used to say, when I would say something which they would understand, then he's telling a lie. If you don't understand it, it's not necessary that I'm lying. You know? It's just that you don't understand it. So, you know, this is what predestination is. It's God's knowledge and it comes true. But it doesn't necessarily mean that because God has already many things, well, everything in his knowledge, everything happens simply because of it, and the person who does it is not to be blamed for it. Well, then, of course, it's not mechanically happening. Honestly, do we not know that it's not mechanically happening? I mean, I put my hand in my pocket. I'm sure that I'm doing it with my own decision making ability. Bring it out, I'm doing it. But it's another matter that what I'm doing was already known to the one who is perfect.
Any other question?
May I ask, with regard to what you were saying earlier, sir, about God judging different groups of people according to what they're able to know, may I ask what the Islamic view of judgment is? How is it possible to answer? I don't know. How God is going to judge people in general, if their good deeds are better than their bad deeds? I don't know if you believe that we've all done bad things. That's my background. That's what I believe. Is it possible to know how God judges? Like, if someone's good deeds are more than their bad deeds, and it weighs up, or
there are, I would say, most of the Muslims have an understanding which I'm not delighted is different from my understanding. So I'll tell you about my understanding. What you mentioned about the understanding of accountability and the scale is what many Muslims believe is going to be the case. And let me make use of this opportunity to say that that is a part of the problem of our misconduct today. I'll tell you why. The general understanding is that all humans, including Muslims, the scales are going to be drawn. Good deeds on the right hand side, bad deeds on the left hand side, and going to be weighed. So ultimately, if the right hand side is going to be the more weightier of the two, the more solid, weighty, it's going to be paradise. And it's going to be the other way around, then it's going to be punishment. And therefore, I'll tell you what the trouble is. Therefore, people sometimes start assuming that, okay, I did tell lies, I'm still telling lies. That is something I can't do without, you know. It's a part of my profession. Whatever. I'm not going to mention any profession, but it's a part of my profession. But then, of course, you know, on the other hand, am I not saying my prayers? Am I not fasting? Am I not going for Hajj pilgrimage? So this is quite clearly more in weight. So this cheating, lying, bluffing compared to my prayers, spending in the way of God is going to be far more weightier. And therefore, those bad deeds are going to be destroyed. My ordinary understanding is that that is the misconception. That is the misconception. In the scales of the Almighty, so do I understand through my reading of the Quran, the only weight that that deeds carry are good deeds and their weight. It is primarily the weight of good deeds that are going to count. You pray or you help somebody else. Now, this is a good deed. These are good deeds. Do they carry any weight or not would depend upon who you are, what your attitude is. Your bad deeds do impact your personality and who you are, how genuinely good you are. So if you're a good person and you pray, your good deed of praying will carry weight. But if somebody is a cheat, a liar, a thief, and is praying, and not bothering to say sorry to God, and is praying only because what he wants to satisfy himself, have a feeling that, okay, I am compensating for it. It may not carry any weight at all. So forget about the fact that they are going to be weighed. There's going to be only one weight that is going to be assigned, and that weight is going to be assigned to good deeds. So if you are going on Umrah in front of the house of God and you do your tawaf, it's either that he's going to actually give you huge rewards because you're a good person back home. You've been helping people. You've been telling the truth. You are a well-meaning, truth-seeking individual. And this pilgrimage is going to cause your deeds to have a lot of weight. But if you're back home, you really have been cheating people. You've been deceiving them, depriving them of their rights. You've been manipulating orphans and others, and you go for Umrah, it will have no weight. So that my understanding is that the Quran says, for example, in one of the verses, again in Surah number 7, chapter number 7, it says, Wal wazno yawma izir al-haq. The wazn, the weight on that day is only going to be assigned to al-haq. What is really haq, true, correct, genuine, and therefore it would carry weight. If there is somebody, and the Quran actually mentions the number of verses, passages. For example, the Quran talks about the fact that the chieftains of Quraysh, they used to pray. But the Quran says, فَوَيْلُ لِلْمُسَلِّينَ, curse be on these people who say their prayers. أَلَّذِينَ هُمْ عَنْ صَلَاتِهِمْ سَاهُونَ, who are unaware, unmindful of their prayers. أَلَّذِينَ هُمْ يُرَاهُونَ, and they show off. وَيَمْنَعُونَ الْمَعُونَ, and they don't even care or bother to share a few minor things of utility with others, with neighbors. A person is saying his prayers 5 times a day, and his or her neighbor comes and says that, can you give me a half cup of milk because, we've exhausted our milk. And the person will just get lost. What kind of people are you? Don't bother me. Why don't you have your own milk? Quran is telling us that if you are saying your prayers, then, this doesn't make sense. How can it happen? So if a person is a good person, then his weight, the weight of good deeds, is going to be there. And if he is a bad person, then his good deeds are a drama. They are just a facade with no real substance. That's what matters.
Any other question?
Just on that, I just wanted to ask, so the half of people you said, so you've got hukukul ibad and hukukullah. So is there any correlationship or interdependency between one dependent on the success of the other or anything like that? Or one is important than the other, or again more heavier than the other, or the success of one depends on the other?
Honestly, God Almighty mentions in the Quran both rights of God and human beings in the same breath. Honestly, it hardly matters if it's God or his creature, human beings. The important thing is the individual cares for rights, cares for what is correct, cares for what is genuinely true. Whether in ignoring what is genuine and true is in ignoring the rights of God or rights of fellow human beings, I think it's only a matter of details. And honest to God, at times, and forgive me, I'm just trying to present a theory. It seemingly what you're doing is very wrong. It's a huge crime. But you don't realize it. You don't even realize. Probably you're not even be going to question. But if what you're doing is seemingly very small, making a slighting remark about somebody else, take it in a manner that you're a criminal and you're full of venom, that small remark is actually going to cause a lot of damage to the future of your deeds. So it all depends on what your attitude is. And obviously, if the attitude of an individual is good, then it is not possible that he or she is going to ignore God's rights or the rights of fellow human beings. There's no way. Why? Yes, at times it is possible that a person is actually influenced by a theory, by an understanding, which causes him or her to believe that, you know, this is more important than that. I believe that there could be two possibilities. Either the person is actually influenced by the theory in a manner that he had no other choice. But God is the best judge, I've already mentioned. He will look at your capacity. Or else it's a temporary phase. And if you're a well-meaning, good person, the influence of the theory on you is going to be short-lived. And you would realize, oh my goodness, what an idiot I was this long. And God will give you the opportunity to correct yourself. Life is an ongoing journey. It's not that once you take a decision when you were a 16 years old young man, that decision would last forever. But if that happens, then there's something wrong. The upper chamber is not being utilized properly. That in itself is a problem. So you know, to be rigid and flexible and to stick to what you have been doing right from the beginning is not a great idea. But you know, rights, whether rights of God or fellow humans, are equally important. And it all depends if law is getting, right is getting violated. It all depends on what the attitude is. And it all is going to be decided by the one who knows everything.